General Lloyd, I thought we'd start out today perhaps by discussing your early career in government, particularly your service with the Division of Public Assistance. Would you tell us about how you became involved in the Division of Public Assistance and the duties that you performed there?
Well, at the time, I was in the Department of History and Political Science up at Morehead State Teachers College, which is now Morehead State University. And being interested in government, teaching political science, I actually kept track of a lot of things and took a considerable amount of interest in the gubernatorial election in 1935 because Happy Chandler, A.B. Chandler, was running for governor, and he was born and raised in the next county from where I was, and I'd known him some time, though he was older than I was. And matter of fact, when I first met him, he was going to Transylvania University, and I was just a senior in high school. And I was for him, and he was elected. He had me convinced that he was sort of a bright young fellow who was riding a white horse, and his opponent, Tom Ray, had horns. I really did. I saw Tom Ray and Doc Beecham, both of whom later became my friends, particularly Doc Beecham. I really thought they had horns. I didn't know them, but I thought they had.
Mm-hmm. Any particular reason that you think you came to
that? Because Happy was always telling me how crooked they were.
I see.
And matter of fact, every speech he made in Kentucky during that campaign, he referred to his opponent, Tom Ray, in this fashion. He said that the bank in Russellville, Kentucky had only been robbed twice, once by Jesse James and secondly by Tom Ray. How you can get by with that type of charges in a campaign, I don't know, but that's the way it was in Kentucky at that time.
Libel was not a big threat in those days.
Not very big. So I was very much favor happy because he was young and he appealed to young people, college group and so on. And I thought he'd make a great governor. He had owed sales tax when he was lieutenant governor, presiding officer of the Kentucky Senate, in which Ruby LaFoon, the governor, had been gotten into that position mainly by Tom Ray's influence, mm-hmm. had favored the sales tax. I thought it was a bad tax myself, but because it was a tax on the necessities of life and applied to people who could pay the least, they're the ones that could pay the best, the most. And as a result of that, I was for happy and supported him, and he wasn't too well known up in the eastern Kentucky where I was teaching, but he got around. And then too, my friend and an older man and a superb, I thought, a statesman, and he was certainly a very successful politician, Judge Ali W. Young, was for Chandler.
Mm-hmm.
So he got in as a governor. We had a double barrel primary that year. Tom Ray had enough influence, and he had expected to get in on the basis of a Democratic state convention. But Ruby LaFoon had to go to Washington as governor to see about getting some money for the highways or some other state purpose. I don't recall now. I think it was highways, though, because highway commissioner went with him.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was gone overnight, Chandler called a special session of the General Assembly for the sole purpose of having a primary in the event that one person didn't get a clear-cut majority in the gubernatorial race. Same thing that they had in a good many southern states, what they call a double-barrel primary.
Mm-hmm. runoff primary.
Yeah. So had that made the very bitter campaign, and had Roosevelt not gone to Washington, Tom Ray would have been nominated for governor, because he got a majority. Well, he could have got, and he could have easily gotten the convention vote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this thing, Reuben Thune thought he'd offset Chandler's political move by calling for a double barrel primary and have a runoff. As it turned out, Ray, of course, passed the thing the way the governor wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And people were very strong for not having a convention anymore. That got to the point where you got a few people in a smoke-filled room, as they say, mm-hmm. deciding who's going to be governor. So Ray got the majority, but not enough for plurality, I should say,
right.
But not a complete majority, and therefore they had a runoff. And the three candidates in the three candidates got most of the votes, and that is Ray first, Chandler second, and Frederick A. Wallace from Parrish, Kentucky, third. And so what happens then, and what usually happens in most southern states, in a situation like that, the third man joined up with the second man to beat the first man.
Mm-hmm.
And Wallace supported with his group of people, and he had a respectful number of voters with Chandler, and Chandler won the runoff. Well, that pleased me, and I felt at home with Chandler and the governor. I could go down and talk with him and,
mm-hmm.
and be of some help in, to my school and that sort of thing. And he turned up and he wanted me to take a job.
Mm-hmm. Could I interject one moment?
Yes.
Can you tell us any specific duties that you performed in this primary process?
Well, when he came up to Moorhead, I went around and introduced him to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't unusual. Somebody came up there
mm-hmm.
that I knew and wanted to meet some county officials, some people that I knew. I did it. Matter of fact, I did the same thing for a fellow known as Walking Munn Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Walking Munn came down to Hopkins County, next county where I was, and he got his name by... He ran against a rather rich person over in Hopkins County who campaigned with a pair of match team horses and a tractor with a surrey with fringe on top in great style, and Munn Wilson walked from one place to the other, and he said if the good people of that county would elect him, he'd walk all the way to Frankfort to get a seat mm-hmm. in the legislature, which he did.
Mm-hmm. Was he as poor as he claimed to be?
Yes, he really was. He was very poor. I mean, he
was a perpetual candidate, as
yeah,
well. He ran many
candidate.
Times.
He ran for United States Senator
mm-hmm.
and a number
mm-hmm.
of things.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember when he was running for Lieutenant Governor,
mm-hmm.
he came up to Moorhead, and I introduced him around because he knew me.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was making a speech out on the campus there, just getting the crowd together, he was making a speech, one of the local policemen came up to arrest him. Or inciting a crowd. somebody else had sent him up there, and I explained to this fellow that he was a bona fide candidate.
Mm-hmm.
He had every right to speak anywhere he wanted to, because he was speaking out on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't take him to jail or got me busted for him. But that's just something I just did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that created more interest among my students.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
you seem to like the underdog at this point in your life. Is that true?
How's that?
You like the underdog in the candidates.
Well, usually. But I didn't vote for Munn Wilson, but I felt the same duty toward him. I would have felt for any candidate. Incidentally, later on, after I became director of public assistance, that probably should come later, but anyway, I'll
mm-hmm.
Vance Little tell you a story about Walking Munn Wilson. He was a real character. And I was in my office one day, and we were having this early part of the program. We were having difficulty in getting sufficient proof of age, you know, the things that are required by the federal government to give them a grant. And somebody came to my office and said, did you know Walking Mun Wilson's in town and up there on the courthouse square making a speech against you? And I said, well, no, what's he saying? He said, well, he says you're one of the plutocrats and you're making a lot of money off the old people, and he can't even get his old age pensions, he calls it. And I called you just a regular crook. And I said, well, I can't imagine Mun doing that, but maybe he has something about it. And I ran into Mun later on the restaurant. And his poverty, so-called, he used to go into the restaurant up there and ask for a cup of hot water. And on the restaurant they had, of course that was free, they gave him a cup of hot water. So then he'd take the tomato sauce, and sprinkle that in the hot water, and the crackers they had there for free for soup, well, I fill it up and that's a bowl of soup, and walk on out without paying anything. But he was a character of that type. But mm-hmm. Anyway, he told me when he said, I made a speech against you. He said, you haven't gotten my old age pension yet. I said, you haven't been able to prove your age yet either. But he believed in hitting anybody. He thought to make a good story and to make some point mm-hmm. to the mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. But I always liked the old Fakadja. He never really did me any harm.
He added to the colorfulness of Kentucky politics but along the way.
Getting back to how I got to be in that job, Governor Chandler wanted, and he had a highway commissioner in that district at the time by the name of Bernard Coughlin, over Maysville. And I knew Bernard, he was a very bright, fine young lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I worked with him some on these political things. And he wanted me to take a job, and the governor offered me a job as director of a new division called Parole and Probation. Well, that did not appeal to me particularly. It appealed to me from the standpoint of taking a new law and developing an organization to implement it, but it didn't pay quite as much as I was making up college, which is low enough. And I turned that down, so Bernard then went to the governor and told him he ought to give me a better job than that, so I might take it. So they offered me to be the director of public assistance, which paid not handsomely, but a little more than I was making at the time. So they wanted me to come down. The law before that went into effect, it was Kentucky's implementation of the Social Security Act of 1935 passed the Congress. And it was supposed to go into effect in Kentucky on July 1, 1936. Mm-hmm. Well, I was obligated to teach summer school for a certain September. I'd already been elected for another year, but certainly I felt obligation. I was already in summer school, and I told them I couldn't come to Franklin until about August 10th, which I recall, I think, was when the summer school ended. So at that time I went down there, and it was a very interesting thing because I've always liked to take something, some department that you start with or something new and see if you can organize it, or take something that reached about as low a point as could reach and reorganize it and see if you could prove it.
It's the political scientist in you.
Yeah. So this was something new starting. But they had to, they felt an urge to get things going as fast as they could. And when I arrived in Frankfort, and summer school was over in August, about the 10th as I recall, I found I already had 240 workers. Now there were not enough trained social workers in Kentucky. I don't think there are more than six or eight graduate social workers with a master's degree in that field in the whole state. They were what the federal government preferred to have as social workers to go with, meet with the clients, prove their qualifications and that sort of thing, and decide on how much money they needed to give an adequate budget. The law in Kentucky was a very, one of the lowest in the state.
Of all the federal system.
Our law provided for a maximum of $30 per month, of which the state could furnish 15, one half, and the federal government would furnish one half. Now, the limit on the federal government, if I recall correctly, was only $30 maximum for their part, and the states could add on that much or any more, much above that they wanted to. So that meant that we weren't even taking final advantage under Kentucky law as passed of the full federal contribution we could have gotten. However, this was during the Depression, and people could live on much less than they have now. But I found we had 200 so-called social workers, so. And when I looked into the way they were appointed, the governor had either himself or had one of his political advisors to call the county chairman that helped him get in, and all the 120 counties, and said, "We're going to need two social workers in your county. Get the best ones you can get," which most of them interpreted as get the ones who did the most for me. Mm-hmm. That is Chandler. So they'd already appointed two. They had two in Jefferson County, the largest populous county in the state, two in Pike County, which has the largest territorial area in the state, and two in Robertson County, which is the smallest in population or area. So that didn't make much sense. But they were there, and so we had to, I did have the help of two or three trained social workers. That one, Miss Margaret Wall, who was put in charge of the training of the social workers. She had been with the Red Cross from the United States of America. And Miss Helen Beecham and two or three others that at least had master's degrees in social work. They were the nucleus I used to train these people. But, and everybody, professional people in social work were very critical of that kind of setup, but we didn't have that many trained people in Kentucky, and we couldn't get them outside the states because their salaries were very small. Bear in mind, this is depression. The trained ones, we paid $150 a month. All these others, the 240 that were not trained, got $125 a month, but they had to pay their own, furnish their own car and pay their own travel. So it was right tough, but Governor Chandler insisted on starting in August that we had to pay somebody, find somebody eligible to get some pay by the end of that month, which increased considerable difficulty while he was trying to organize. Because he wanted the old people, he wanted to try to get two from every county to be in there the last of August and get checks. He wanted to get the checks out personally.
Were they roughly equally divided between men and women, or were there far more men?
I don't remember the statistics on the time, but roughly. You had actually more women, I think. Certainly the population figures, I'm sure, show that there were more elderly women still living at the time than were men.
No, I meant that the social workers.
Oh, no, practically all women, social workers, yeah.
All women.
Well, we had, I remember one that we had who was one man who was a trained social worker. Years later, he took my place as director, but he's been dead now a good many years. But in the ones in the counties, we had more women than did men. Men worked, they didn't care too much about that type of work. Mm-hmm. And they preferred to get a job with a foreman on the highway gang mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that.
Which probably paid more.
But we, yeah. Well, not much more, so wasn't too much. But we did have some men. Mm-hmm. And the same is true in the office force. We had an office force, we had more women or girls than mm-hmm. we did men, but we had some men. Men were on jobs such as like the head of the mail section and on getting the supplies and out to the workers and all that kind of business. So we turned out, we managed to get, I don't remember today exactly the number, but we did get a respectable, I'll put it that way, not two from every county, but at least two or three or four from a great many counties in the state to come up there. And the field worker, we called our social workers field workers, the ones that actually worked out in the field in the county. And they brought them in their automobiles. And if you're familiar with Kentucky, you have very hot weather in August. Excuse me. And the state capital, where the governor wanted to have the big gathering and a big show about handing out the checks, was going to be in the House or chamber or the House chamber of the state capital. And there was no air conditioning in the capital in those days. To make it worse, the House chamber had a big glass dome over it with a 95, 100 degree heat beating down the dome and then down on the people below. Why, it was like an oven. Mm-hmm. I was, and all my horse there were very much concerned that we brought in a lot of people over 65 in there on a hot August afternoon, and the heat was about 120. We might have a bunch of people just pass out, die. It took a little ingenuity. What they did on that was that we managed to get a lot of big wash tubs. In those days, ice companies made ice and big blocks, 300-pound blocks mostly. We got a bunch of tubs, put them all around a semicircle in front of the speaker's stand, and we put all our old age recipients in the front row in the House chamber. We had to bring in a lot of chairs, excuse me, and put some great big tall fans, height of the 300-pound block, which we set up mm-hmm. long ways, behind those, blow cool air out over the audience, and fortunately nobody died. And the governor made a great speech, which he was ridiculed with some of the newspapers about, but I'm sure the recipients were right pleased. They probably were disappointed in the amount of the grants because they all didn't even get $30. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I think the average is about 15. Mm-hmm. But it was a big ceremony, except where the governor was criticized because he was handing out checks from maybe as low as 7 up to as high as 20 or 30. And he told them, please do not go out and buy whiskey with this or spend it in riotous living.
He used those words.
Those exact words, yeah. But anyway, we worked on, and gradually we were criticized for the slowness in some places. As I said, we just didn't have really trained people to do that type of work, but we trained them the best we could. But they weren't bad. I found that most of them really were precinct workers. Mm-hmm. They were who helped the campaign manager in the county do most of the work during the campaign. And I found that real good precinct captains or something in any rural county, they have a deep feeling for people who are in trouble or people who have needs and that sort of thing. And they were very conscientiously to try to get the legal aspects of the qualifications worked out so that when the federal government have an audit, we wouldn't lose money on people by them not being eligible. That went on some time, and gradually I found this to be true. Of course, we had another election in the fall. Kentucky has an election every year. And while we did not permit our workers to, even though it might have been precinct workers before, we did not permit them to continue that type of work. Mm-hmm. I was accused somewhat because the word had gotten around. Of course, we had in that election, while the people that the forces of Governor China preferred to be in office than people that were responsible for the other faction. So a lot of highway workers particularly were being assessed mm-hmm. on the basis of 2% of their salaries to contribute to the campaign. I did not permit any assessment on our workers because we were in a condition of dispersing mm-hmm. federal as well as state money. Mm-hmm. And though when a worker came to me and told me he or she wanted to contribute something and asked if I'd take the money, I'd say, yes, I'll take it. Put it in give it to the hands of whoever's mm-hmm. supposed to be getting it. That didn't cause any particular trouble. I didn't think anything about it. Matter of fact, some people, when they want to contribute that much money, and I didn't think were financially able to do so on account of big family or something, mm-hmm. I'd say don't contribute that much. I'm sure that didn't please some of the politicians, but that's the way I did it. I really didn't, it wasn't until the next senatorial election.
Did 38?
Really get into the problem on that.
That's the Barkley-Chandler
race. Mm-hmm. And of course, the federal people and all these, they were very careful that they didn't want any people mm-hmm. drawing money, half of which came from the mm-hmm. federal government. Working for Chandler and mm-hmm. so on, and neither did the state want, neither did Chandler want people he had appointed and paid working in Barkley.
As you know, though, it's often been said that most of the state workers work for Chandler and most of the federal workers work for Barkley, and that's where both of them found their strengths in that election. I mean, that's the common charge.
That's true. I was called up one day by someone representing the federal government. And I think he was an FBI man wanting me to, he put it very plainly, he said, your workers are being assessed. I said, no. He said, we hear they're being assessed, and I want to talk to you about it. Do you want to meet me, or do you want me to send a subpoena? I said, I have nothing to hide, and I be glad to meet you wherever you want to. Well, he was in Bowling Green and I was in Frankfort, but I went down to Bowling Green to meet him. And he raised these questions about assessment. I said, we haven't assessed anybody. He said, well, you told them they ought to give a certain amount. I said, no. I said, I told them they had a right to give anything they wanted to. And if they wanted to give a certain percent of the salary or more than that or less than that, we left that up to them. He said, didn't you collect most of the money? And I said, well, a great deal of it, yes. They brought it to me and I took it. He said, what'd you do with it? Well, I said, I put it in the bank first, under a fund account, and when I got enough, to turn it over to somebody, or I took it over and turned it over to them. He said, well, who'd you turn it over to? I said, well, I turned it over to Sherman Goodpasture. He said, who's Sherman Goodpasture? Well, I said, he's the head of the state insurance department. He said, why'd you turn it over to Sherman Goodpasture? I said, well, before I came down here to Frankfort, I lived in the next county to Bass County, and he was one of the strong Democrats in Bass County, and if I wanted to contribute something, I usually took it over and gave it to him. And so I just followed the same pattern. He said, well, do you mean he was a straight treasurer for the campaign? I said, no, not as far as I know. He's just one of the compartment heads, and I just turned it over to him. He said, well, did you turn over a list? I said, no. He said, do you have a list? I said, no. Of course, I'd...
Maybe we could backtrack a little bit to the list.
Okay. What do you want me to do now?
Oh, would you go back and discuss from
the
list?
Well, he asked if I had a list, which I did not have, because I want to be in a position to not to have one.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, what do you think? You know all the money that you collected. Well, I said, I didn't collect it. I didn't solicit it. I took it when they offered it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, you know all that went to Chandler. Not many of it go to Barker, didn't you? I said, well, I can't swear to that. I gave it to Sherman Goodpasture. But knowing Sherman, I said, I know that none of it went to the Republicans. And that's the way we left it. He didn't, I never was again questioned about it.
Did you ever discuss this later with Sherman Goodpasture?
Oh, yeah, I think I told him about it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, did he ever say that it all went to Chandler?
Well, I didn't ask him.
Oh. Just an understanding, I see. Okay. While we're on this topic, as you know, there are many people who claim that the idea of an assessment, particularly the 2% assessment, remained a factor in Kentucky politics, according to many, up until about the early 1960s and the Combs administration. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it's been pretty much handled that way, most part. I never did. I never did that when I was employed by the later on the Legislative Research Commission. Because even when after war, when I came back to Kentucky, I was engaged in, Earl Clements asked me, he was in Congress, and he's getting ready to run for governor, and he asked me if I not to take my job back with the state, I could have had under the Kentucky law.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Republican governor at that time. And while I'm sure I couldn't have gotten the same job back, because I don't think he would have given it to me, but he would have given me some job, comparable perhaps in salary, because
mm-hmm.
I was a law. And I didn't care too much about doing that. And Earl asked me not to. He talked to me and said he's going to run for governor, and he wanted me to help him in his campaign. He wanted me to be in a position where I could do so legally.
Mm-hmm.
And just not take the job back under Republican. So that's what I did.
So you waited it out?
So I waited that out, and I worked down Cummins' headquarters in Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that at that time, a lot of workers who had been appointed by the Republican governor were possibly assessed or given mm-hmm. an opportunity to contribute to the party's campaign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the same is true of people who had relations with the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
I expect it still goes on.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any inside comments about the 1938 U.S. Senate race? I mean, do you have any particular recollections that perhaps we would not likely find in print or from other discussions with people?
I would not like to find in print.
No. Let me rephrase that. Do you have any anecdotes or inside information about the 1938 race, which we would not likely pick up from other sources?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, there was a, I'm sure that you had a lot of federal workers who were violating the federal law
mm-hmm.
and doing things for Senator Barkley at and a lot of state people were out working. I would have normally been for Senator Barkley
mm-hmm.
due to the fact that he had came from West Kentucky and been our congressman and then our senator, and had my parents and my grandparents had been for him
mm-hmm.
every time
mm-hmm.
he ran.
Mm-hmm.
I was not for him in the campaign in which he ran against Chandler. I can give you one comment on the situation, which is, I understood, but it's kind of amusing, because great stress was made about the federal merit system and civil mm-hmm. service and all that sort of thing. We were in Kentucky was in a regional district of the Federal Social Security Board, which included the states of Michigan, Ohio, and Kentucky. Of course, Kentucky had very few things in common with Michigan or even Ohio, because of the joint boundary with Ohio. But one of the members of the Social Security Board came to see me after this race was over, and Barkley was elected and back up in Washington. He came down from the Cleveland office. They put the district Social Security office in Cleveland itself, mostly halfway in between Michigan and Kentucky. And he came down to see me, and he wanted me to apply. They had a vacancy. There was an Army Brigadier General by the name of Crowell. During that period of the Depression, a lot of the Army couldn't get enough funds to pay a lot of the people. They put them on detached service many times to fill in other government positions so that it wouldn't,
mm-hmm.
the overall cost wouldn't be as mm-hmm. great. And Brigadier General Crowell was the executive, or whatever you want to call him, up there in the Social Security Board office in Cleveland. I knew him real well, a very capable administrator, and but he was getting ready to retire. So this man from the Cleveland office came down to me and said, we've talked it over up there in the Cleveland office, and we would like for you to apply for the head of that office, Social Security Board, Civil Service Commission. And I said, well, I haven't got a chance. He said, oh, yes, yes. It's an unassembled examination. You don't have to examine anything. It'll take your background and credentials, degrees and experience, and compile it and come up with a, and you were bound to be one of the top three. And I said, well, I don't think I can get it in. He said, well, you're bound to be, because you got Senator Barkley. He's the strongest man in the Senate. And I said, he won't be for me. He said, well, he's bound to be for you because you're from Kentucky. He wouldn't turn down Kentucky in order to get somebody from some other state. And I said, I don't think you know Barkley that well. Well, he said, we want you to do it. We're all for you. You're the only one that has a PhD. You're the only one that's been active in this program to the point where you know it real well. And we think you'll be the top one of the three, and Barkley will have to be for you. And I said, well, if you all want it that badly, I'll apply. Which I did. And I never did expect to move to Cleveland, however. Because Barkley was the kind of man that he would remember such things as that. And what made me mad about it, though, was that after about 3 or 4 weeks, I got a letter from the Social Security, not Social Security, I mean the Civil Service Commission up in Washington, telling me they were very sorry that my record and application had been reviewed and I did not qualify in the top three, which was no surprise to me, but a great surprise to the people in the Cleveland office. And they came back down and said, God, we don't understand it. I said, well, I understand it. Not necessary if you understand it. Well, they said, you ought to do something about it. Said, there's just something wrong up there. Well, I said, okay. He said, what do you want to do? And he said, well, you ought to file a protest and ask another review. I said, all right, I'll do that. And I did. In the meantime, they appointed a man from Ohio as the head of the office up there. And after that had been done, I got another reply back in the Civil Service Commission that they had reviewed my record and qualifications and found I did qualify for the job, but there was no vacancy at this time.
That's a good way around it. That's a good
story.
Well,
that's the way you learn about federal politics.
Did Barkley ever say anything to you afterwards about it?
No. No. I never said anything about it. Mm-hmm. Because later on, when I was up there in Washington with the backup people, well, before that, I was up there during the war, and I was dropped by his top secretary, who lived in the same apartment building my wife and I did, and the same Clements was in the same, he and his wife in the same apartment building, a bunch of Kentuckians there. We were all friendly and everything, so. And I didn't dislike Barkley, I liked him. But I never said anything about that. And he was helping me when I was on anything else I ever asked him for.
Did you work for any of his other campaigns later on?
Well, I was a delegate to the National Convention when Truman was...
48?
Yeah, in 48 I was a delegate-at-large from Kentucky up there, and I supported Barkley all down the line to get to be nominated president.
And in 52, did you support him?
Yes, I think
so. When he was he's being run for president.
Yeah.
Came in.
But I supported him in the Democratic Convention up there, but I learned something in that convention, too. Kentucky delegation was, and I think most of the delegations were right despondent. They just didn't have the fire. They just they didn't think he would win. And Barkley made the keynote speech at that convention, and he had the only, I mean, he made a fire speech about an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And he aroused the only spontaneous enthusiasm
mm-hmm.
during that entire convention.
Mm-hmm.
When his speech was over, the delegates got out in the aisles and they whooped it all up and everything for about an hour, another hour or so. But I learned this, though, the security on that convention was very great. Of course, Truman wanted to get it,
mm-hmm.
and you had to.
But he didn't really want Barclay, did he?
Hmm?
But Truman really did not want Barclay, did he?
No, no. But we wanted Barclay president. Truman wanted to be president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we had the only spontaneous, real celebration after his speech. But the next day, when they're going to nominate. Up for nomination. Security was tight. If you didn't have your delegate badge, you couldn't get in there.
Mm.
And four, and of course, they had all the balconies, but they weren't letting anybody in until suddenly people appeared from everywhere. They brought in over the hundreds. And all the spaces were given to these people supporting Truman. And they really turned on.
That was a surprise to you, I gather.
Well, it was a surprise to me to see,
mm-hmm.
see it done so openly
mm-hmm.
and without regard to
mm-hmm.
any
mm-hmm.
kind of a,
mm-hmm.
after all, they're all Democrats, supposed
mm-hmm.
to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't. Now, I learned to like Truman, but he didn't inspire that convention very much.
Mm-hmm. As Barclay had.
Well,
mm-hmm.
of course, We could elect it, Barclay. We could nominate him. Trouble.
you feel pretty strong about that? That Barclay could have been elected.
Yeah, he could have been elected. And I followed that campaign somewhat. I remember when Truman came down to Kentucky. Put him in the presidential suite down at the Kentucky Hotel, and some people in power had got some people in there to talk to him. They'd talk to, I guess, 50 to 75, 80 people in that suite. And I was among those that were, I'm sure that was the Clements, invited. And I sat there and heard. He was a nice fellow, but I just sat there and thought, well, I believe he was the only person in that room thought he was going to be elected.
Mm.
Well, we wanted it to be, we just didn't think he had a chance.
Mm.
But he was confident all along. And I learned something from the standpoint of politics, practical politics, in that election, and that I was discouraged, but I was working for him. I'm trying to do what I could to get him elected. I think most everybody in the Democrat Party in Kentucky did. And I should have gotten something out of this. I drive, as part of work, I drove about old state a lot. If I stop at the gas station, I'd probably say something about, or if I'd see a Truman button on somebody or a Barclay button, I'd
mm-hmm.
talk about how the election was. I heard time and time again people say, well, I tell you, it's pretty tight down here. I'm going to vote for that little fellow Truman. I don't think he's got a chance, but I'm going to be for him. And you heard that a lot.
Mm-hmm. The little fellow.
Yeah. He had the sympathy of all of them, and
mm-hmm.
that's how he got elected.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned out to be a good president, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he certainly didn't have
the charisma or the...
He wanted a Jack Kennedy, but I mean, or Roosevelt.
We're a little ahead of ourselves here, but while we're on the 1948 election, maybe I might ask you this question. Clements, as I recall, and Ed Pritchard both put together an arrangement to get Wilson Wyatt of Louisville to write the nomination speech for Barkley for VP in 48. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I think that that is correct, though I always had the impression that Clements was the one who maneuvered it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, Wilson Wyatt was one of the three people being considered by Truman as a running mate. And Wyatt says, and I believe he says it in his recent book, that he was the first choice among the three. And so to get Wyatt to make that nomination address for Barkley must have been a major feat. And as the story was related to me some years back, if I recall it correctly, Clements and Pritchard, along with Wyatt, wrote out the basics of that address on the back of an old envelope very hastily, very shortly before it was given. And as I understand it, it was a very well done address.
Well, it was. I don't. I knew nothing about it at the time. Though Wyatt has done a number of things that I mean, he's shrewd himself. He wouldn't. He'd do things like that frequently. I think, and Clements had a lot of influence on him. Matter of fact, you remember.
Well, 59, he influenced him very greatly, yeah, as I recall.
Yeah.
To put that ticket together.
59, he.
My Combs Wyatt ticket.
Yeah, he got Wyatt to take second place there.
Something that many people thought would be impossible.
That's right.
Do you recall anything else about that 48 election?
Well,
You know, you were in attendance. And
well, I was. I mean, I think everybody ought to go to a national convention once. And I enjoyed seeing it. But I will remember to my dying day, though, that when I've forgotten who actually made the nominating speech for Truman. But I remember, to my amazement, that they had an even bigger demonstration on his nomination. I mean, for the vote second, just when he nominated. And they had the preceding day when Barkley gave the keynote speech. People by the hundreds, as they say, from all the balcony and everything poured down the aisles and down the front, hollering and whooped and went on. And I stood up and I thought, gee, what in the world is happening? When Barkley came on, made his keynote speech, and here there's all this enthusiasm. And I stood up in the seat and looked around. There were practically no delegate seats empty. These were all outside people, federal government workers, and that's all outside people that were allowed in there
to beef it up, huh?
And I guess paid the wheeler to move it up. They were not delegates.
That's an interesting comment. Very
but
interesting.
Of course, on TV, you couldn't tell the difference.
Sure. interested.
Another thing in that collection, it so happened that our seats of Kentucky were just in front. They tied the seats of delegates alphabetically. Uh-huh. And we were just in front of the seats from Minnesota. You remember who the governor of Minnesota at that time?
That was the farmer labor right?
No.
See, Humphrey was the mayor.
Well, that's the fellow. He wasn't governor, you're right. He was mayor.
Minneapolis mayor, yeah. Hubert Humphrey.
But Hubert Humphrey was very anxious to be very prominent in this convention.
Right, right. Well, I couldn't remember the governor.
Yeah, well, I was. It was Hubert Humphreys, and he sat right behind me. And he's always demanding to be recognized as a chair. He's just like a jack-in-the-box. He'd jump up and holler, "Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman." And usually the chairman had a list of people he could recognize who he didn't, and he wouldn't recognize him. But unfortunately, Hubert had he came in with the morning paper, which he always rolled up, and he banged back down on, keep hitting me on top of the head. "Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman." This went on quite a while. I mean, the chairman recognized somebody, and he'd sit down, but the next time he got a chance, he jumped again. And after he did that three or four times, you know, he was a small fella.
Uh-huh. You're pretty big.
Well, I was 6'1". And it got tiresome. My head was getting sore. And so I finally got up, and he was seated at that time. And when I got up in my seat, looked back at him, I almost towered over him. And I shouldn't have done this, but I said, "You little son of a bitch, if you hit me in the head another time, I'm going to knock the hell out of you." And his mouth gaped open, and he said, he looked like no one ever said that before. he said, I'm sorry. But the reason I told you that is because later on, when I was Adjutant General of Kentucky, and we had I was president of the National Association of Adjutant Generals. Mm-hmm. And we had our annual meeting.
You didn't tell me that last time.
I didn't. No.
Left that point out.
When I was up there for this, our annual meeting at the General Association, it was being held in Washington, and that was when Hubert was vice president and wanted to be president. Mm-hmm. So our office in Washington got a letter from the vice president that said, if we should decide to want him to talk or appear before our convention, he'd certainly try to make it possible. Which is, after all, you know, the vice president, the president's commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy and all the armed forces, and the vice president is within a heartbeat of him, the commander-in-chief. So there was nothing to do except invite him to make the big speech at our convention, which we did. And I, as president, had to introduce him.
Mm-hmm. What year is this?
This was, about 66 or 7. Mm-hmm. I think it's 67. So we invited him over, and I hoped he wouldn't recognize me. Every time he saw me, I was in full uniform. So I don't think he ever did. Well, it would have been embarrassing if he'd referred to that. But I gave him a good introduction, and he made a good speech, and everything was fine. But I never forget the look on his face when I said that to him. I said, "Hey, I should have done that, but after all, I was tired of being hit in the head."
Sure. It's a good anecdote.
There's a lot of things happen like that. One thing, if you want some music thing, I at the convention, National Convention of Pittsburgh, some delegate that I knew from down in Tennessee, I've forgotten his name now, but he's about my age, and I was fairly young in those days. So he suggested we go out to find where the best nightclub was. And go out to see the show. See whatever kind of entertainment they had. So we got a cab and told him he wanted to go to the best nightclub. Ask him what the best nightclub. He said, well, the most popular and best nightclub in Pittsburgh is sort of a private affair. It's called the Bachelor's Club. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, take us there. And he said, well, I can take you out there. It's kind of out the edge of town. Put a long drive, and I'd be glad to take you there, but I doubt if you can get in when you get there. Well, we said, well, try it anyway. We'll see what we can do. I said, well, I was a member of the Bachelor Club in Frankfort, Kentucky. There wasn't, as far as I know, than there was in the national organization of those clubs. So we drove out there, and they had a kind of a speakeasy kind of door where they looked through and don't know whether you had to get your card and that sort of thing. I told them I didn't have, wasn't a member of their club, but I was a member of the Bachelor's Club at Frankfort, Kentucky, and I said, we always reciprocate whenever your members are down that way and entertain them. Of course, we didn't even have a clubhouse in Frankfort. And so the fellow looked through the hole and talked to somebody else, and he said, come on in. And to my amazement, we went in, the floor show was being announced and conducted by Charlie Forrester, who's the mayor of Louisville. And a whole bunch of Kentuckians in there.
He probably brought along his rebel yell, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, now, where are you on
that? Okay, well, there was one question that perhaps it might be appropriate to ask this now that I was thinking about as you were talking about 48. And that was back in 44, your governor, your prior governor, who you served under, wanted very desperately the presidential nomination. And afterwards, A.B. Happy Chandler said that, you know, he thought that he, in effect, had been robbed of that presidential nomination by the faction within the Democratic Party, and that he would have been elected, as young as he was, in 1944. And of course, at that time, he had been serving in the U.S. Senate. Some detractors would argue that he, Happy Chandler, had been hurt by the pool issue and the war materials issue that had come up before the Senate Investigation Committee, as you know, which was headed by, of all people, better repeat some of that previous question. In 1944, Happy Chandler claimed that he had a very good shot at becoming president, and he thought he would have had it had not some of the people in the Democratic Party, particularly in the Kentucky Democratic Party, opposed him. Now, some of the people who are among his detractors believe that he, Happy Chandler, had been hurt by the swimming pool charges and the war restricted materials charges relating to the swimming pool that was built in his backyard.
But it was an interesting period because Harry Truman in 42, 43, I believe, had served on the Senate Investigation Committee, which had basically exonerated Happy Chandler of having used war-restricted materials in that pool. But the 1944 election, of course, was one of the more fascinating elections, and Chandler believed that he had a good shot at it, and later on he also, I believe, thought he had a good shot in 1956 as well. But can you fill us in on what you knew about the 44 presidential election, and did you have any role in it? Did you work for Chandler?
I had no role in that election. Mm-hmm. In 44, summer of 44, I was in New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
So I had nothing to do in that election because I'd been immediately upon Pearl Harbor happening, while I had wired the War Department. Those days it was the War Department, so the Department of Defense, that requested that my ineligibility and overage and grade in the reserves be waived and I be ordered to active duty, and I was ordered to active duty. By the time I'd gotten back to Kentucky, I was down in Florida, and I came back to Kentucky. I had ordered the time I arrived here. So then I went on to on active duty, and so and during the actual election, I was over in, at least most of the campaign, I was over in New Guinea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They brought me back here in July, but outside of just passing by through Kentucky on the way to Washington, I was still on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took no part in that election at all. I think that, to answer your question, I think that the investigation probably, I knew when the cabin and the swimming pool were built. And I knew the contractor who built it, who'd done business with the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it was general knowledge, I think, that he built this pool and the cabin and with little to no cost to the censor.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't swear to that because I never heard it one way or the other, but I'm sure that the cost was not commensurate with the Happy may have paid him something, but commensurate with the value of the materials at that time. That hurt him. That probably hurt him more by merely the fact that he was investigated by the Truman Committee than it is here in Kentucky, because most Kentuckians weren't surprised. What would have hurt him in Kentucky more than anything else is the fact that he resigned from the Senate later on became baseball commissioner after the election. That Kentuckians didn't like that very well. Of course, fortunately, he's lived long enough that he's become a legend.
He did win re-election as the governor.
Yeah, that's right.
After resigning in 1950, I believe.
When you become a legend, people, you're a legend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You overcome such things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll be back a little bit again to fill in a few gaps. Can you give us any sketches of other people who served in the first Chandler administration, people who you knew fairly firsthand, and can you tell us anything about what you thought of their capabilities? As you know, there are many people who believe that the first Chandler administration was among the best, if not the best, gubernatorial administration in 20th century Kentucky government. And you worked, I believe, under Vigo Barnes, Commissioner Barnes.
I knew Vigo very well, but we were in different departments.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he was, in that period of time, Chandler was the governor, and I was director of public assistance, which was in the welfare department. Vigo was director of the unemployment compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not... Different parts.
I was thinking they were together at that point.
No, later on he became, when we under Clement's administration, when we, and I was, of course, not in the department at all. Well, I was commissioner. Clement's first appointed me commissioner of welfare. Mm-hmm. But he and I agreed on the thing that the welfare department had gotten such a conglomerate, mm-hmm. part of many divisions and so on, mm-hmm. And needed to be reorganized and refined and so on, and that's what happened. So then you got the created Department of Economic Security, mm-hmm. which became, well, the whole department and the whole division of public assistance was moved into it intact. And Vigo was the head of it. And also still had unemployment competition and so on. Getting back to Happy, I think certainly no doubt in my mind that his first administration was materially better than the second administration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason for it was to the people that were his closest advisors. I'm not including myself as one. Vigo Barnes might have been, but the man closest to him was Dan Talbot. Mm-hmm. And Dan had been close to him all along during the whole campaign, all the time he'd been lieutenant governor. Mm-hmm. Dan Talbot was helping him plan and organize and get ready to run for mm-hmm. governor. Mm-hmm. So I think that Dan Talbot is due the credit. He never got it. Chandler, I don't think, but it's due the credit for making a good governor. As far as I can tell, I've always admired Dan Talbot as being one of the most honest politicians I've known. Mm. He had a chance to get lots of money through politics, but he died broke. Mm. Dan Talbot was, I've seen him pound the desk. Happy, he used to have some occasionally have different department heads and division heads over for breakfast and talk over things about the way the government's running and political politics and so on. And sometimes I've heard Dan over there, Dan was always there when I was there, for example. I think he's there most of the time. But Happy would want to do something or something, Dan would say, "Damn it, Happy. You can't do it. They pound this. That's not quite honest. You're not going to do it." In the second administration, Dan Talbot was dead. Mm. But, and he Dan Talbot was Happy's no man. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. During the first administration. Mm-hmm. Happy would somebody go around over to Happy's office to want a job or get something done. He'd say, "Oh, fine, you, my friend. Take this note and go down top. He'll get it done for you." That guy probably didn't deserve it in the first place. Probably wasn't qualified. And probably hadn't even been for Happy. Mm-hmm. And he'd go over and Dan, who had a terrible, keen memory, guy came in with a note from Happy Chandler to put this fellow in the highway job, so and so. I've heard that, and Dan talked to someone. He said, "Why, you son of a bitch, you were named Forrest. You're not going to get a job." So he had to do that so much that when he wanted to run for Congress over in the 4th District, he had everybody mad at him. He didn't get very far. You can't be a no man in politics.
I recall that. Mm-hmm.
You can't be a no man in politics mm-hmm. and get very far elected. Mm-hmm. But Happy had some good people in this mm-hmm. administration. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons that he offered me a job and part of a thing. He did it intentionally, not on my account, but that was during a period of time when Roosevelt was getting a lot of favorable publicity about his brain trust. He had a bunch of university professors from Harvard and various places up there and getting them jobs, so Happy took a leaf out of Roosevelt's book. And he got Jim Martin, who was at the University of Kentucky.
Finance.
Mm-hmm. Got John Manning, who's a political science professor at the university, put him over in personnel. He pulled me out of Moorhead and put me in the welfare department. And later on, he picked other people who stayed on, and like Clyde Reeves, who's a protege of Martin's and so on, and other people that brought into the thing. And I think by large, well, this fellow Chairman Goodpasture was, I spoke about earlier. He was a good administrator and sharp. And a real gentleman with it. I mean, he was a distinguished looking, he looked like a statesman. But could deal with people and compromises made and all that sort of thing. Happy had a good money like that. I can name many more, I think, but that's why his first administration was more successful.
And so your point is that in his second administration, there seems to have been a relative absence of the same caliber of people. Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, and then didn't have any of them that were powerful enough to say no and make it stick. I mean, some of them might advise him not to do something and have to get mad. He didn't like to take advice.
There wasn't really any single person who could stand up to him.
That's right.
As some of the people in the first administration could have and did.
Yeah.
That's an interesting point. Fascinating point. What about Keene Johnson?
Well, Keene Johnson did exactly as he promised to do when he ran for governor. He said, "I'm going to be a frugal governor." And he believed in being frugal and honest. He didn't have much glamour. There were many things he didn't know about politics, but he tried to learn. For example, when he first came in as governor, he, over a period of time, he scheduled all of his department heads and so on to come in the governor's office and talk about problems. What, if they thought anything wrong with the department, he wanted to know it. If something that happened that shouldn't have happened, he wanted to know it. He wanted to know how they could, what their idea would be about improving things. And he was sincere in it. Happy was not the kind of person who wanted to hear anything bad. He'd make Happy awfully mad if you told him something he didn't want to hear. Earl Clements, on the other hand, was the opposite of that. Earl, as governor, if you're going to tell him some good thing that happened in your department or something, he'd say, "Oh, that's fine, I'm glad that's true, but where are we hurting? What's wrong? What do we need to do better?" That was his approach.
That's interesting. I had never heard it, the differences between the two expressed quite in that manner.
Well, I'll give you an example. Up in old congestion district up there, and this was when in the old 8th district, back when Happy was running for senator. He tried to get everybody involved in working for him and everything. Fine. And he had a lot of yes men around him. Mm-hmm. He always did. Mm-hmm. But I remember this real well. They had a big gun. Rally from China where he was going to speak up to Moorhead. On the view of the fact that I knew a lot of people in Moorhead, he told me to be sure and be there. I was there. We had a big crowd. The courthouse was crowded. The courtroom itself couldn't hold them all. They were scattered out, mm-hmm. or even out on the lawn.
Mm-hmm. Allie Young was there.
No, Allie Young was dead by then.
He was dead by then.
Yeah. But he had loudspeakers out so the mm-hmm. crowd could hear him out on the courthouse lawn. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of enthusiasm. And I really didn't see him much in the crowd, and I was greeting people and so on. And then I was supposed to be over at Flemingsburg at night. A fellow named Pierce Plummer, who did now, was the highway commissioner of that district. And they put on a whaler rally over at Flemingsburg, and again the courthouse was filled with it. The yard was filled, everything was filled. And one of Happy's aides told me that the governor wanted to see me right after speaking up in the jury room off the courtroom. So after speaking's over, I went up there and went in. There was about 20, 30 people in there, all of them friendly politicians. And Abby said, he used to call me doctor. He said, Doc, I saw you up in Moorhead this afternoon, but I didn't get a chance to talk to you. That's why I want to talk to you tonight. How much am I going to carry around county by? That's Moorhead's county. Mm-hmm. I said, Governor, you want me to tell you the truth? He said, why, hell yes, I want the truth. Well, I said, the truth is, you're going to lose it. And to my amazement, he jumped on his feet and pounded it up and said, you're against me. You're against me. Mm. He wouldn't say that if you were against me. Did you see all that crowd of people? Did you hear all the cheering? I said, yeah, Governor, you had a lot of that. But most of those people don't vote in Ryan County. They're from all over the mountains up here to work for the highway department. And that's true. And he lost it. Mm. But he was just mad as hell at me. Mm.
Which raises an interesting question. You had obviously, you know, worked for Chandler and you worked for Clements. In the early 50s, those two forces really bashed heads, bashed them fiercely, beginning in late 1950-51. Weatherby ran for the Senate, and then there was for governor, and then there were the senatorial races. And of course, by 55, when Chandler, 54-55, when Chandler was reelected and served again for a second administration, there was a lot of bitterness there between the Chandler faction and the Clementine Weatherby faction, as it's often said. How did you find yourself amidst all of that?
Well, I was on a different team then. I was on the Clements Weatherby team. Mm-hmm. I wasn't for Chandler that time.
I realize that, but you know, how did Chandler take that?
Well, he didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. Out on our farm out near Midway, we have kind of a recreational log cabin. And Clements, when he came in as governor, loved a thing called a varmint dinner. Mm-hmm. And we used to have, use Jim Kamek, who's head of the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. We usually sort of went back and forth from, he'd have a farm dinner over at his house, and I'd have a farm dinner mm-hmm. out on the farm in my cabin.
Oh, you had some farmer dinners too?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize it. As we both know, you know, Chandler made some accusations about the varmint dinners.
Yeah, well.
This time, I don't want to steal your fire, but well, go ahead.
What my friend Lewis Cox, state senator, and my friend Dick Maloney, both mm-hmm. of them are on my legislative search commission.
Mm-hmm.
And that was during the period of time which I was mm-hmm. director of the legislative search commission. Came by to see me one day and told the captain, and they said, we want you to have a barber dinner. And I said, fine, I'll be glad to. And who do you want to invite? I said, well, we want to pick very carefully who we invite. We want to invite all the friends we can get who are friends of Chandler's, but are for Weatherby. And we want you to personally invite Chandler, too. Mm. Well, that's what we did. We had a big farm dinner with, I guess maybe 115.
Need a lot of varmint.
We had a lot of varmint. We had groundhog and coon and rabbit and duck and squirrels and all kinds of varmints. The idea was that I didn't plan anything. I just helped cooperate and carry it out. But their idea was to get a lot of people. We knew that our side or our team, whatever you want to call it, was going to be for Weatherby. We knew China wanted to run. And we wanted to get all the China friends we could who were for Weatherby out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we missed very many. And I don't think we had anybody who was for Chandler over Weatherby either. So we had the barber dinner, happy came. And everybody's, talked and finally we ate, and so after we ate, we ordinarily didn't have any big speeches or anything, but happy indicated he wanted to say a word. So there we got everybody quiet, and I'll tell you another person we invited. He wasn't what you call a politician, but a friend of both of them, Earl Ruby,
mm-hmm.
from the Courier Journal. And anyway, we happily got up, and he did it very graciously. I was quite amazed. He said, kind of said in the side talk to Lawrence, said, Lawrence, as I tell you, I've been thinking strongly about running for governor. And I know you're running for governor. And I've been out here and I found a lot of my old friends, and I found all of them are for you. So I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not going to run. So he didn't, he ran the next time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But of course, I bet he didn't get anybody that was there though,
mm-hmm.
that time either.
So that varmint dinner may have made the difference between him running in 50...
Well, it was calculated to do that.
For that 50-51.
Yeah, it was calculated to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But now to follow that up on that, to show you how it is, when he was elected, and I was still director of the Legislative Research Commission. And I knew Happy wouldn't want me in there.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it was not a gubernatorial appointment. The director was appointed by the Legislative Research Commission, which is composed by the leaders, mm-hmm. all ex officio,
mm-hmm.
at that time, of both the Republican and the Democratic leadership in both houses, plus the Lieutenant Governor. And of course, I knew what I'd done. It didn't sit well with the governor. But he wasn't running. He said he wasn't going to run, so it wasn't a question of me coming out and saying, happy I wanted to be for you, I can't be, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So a few days, you know, the governor's inaugurated first Monday in December. And the legislature, the General Assembly, does not meet until January. Harry Davis, who has a strong
executive secretary,
supporter of Chandler, and later became executive secretary, came by my office to see me. And Harry and I had known each other some time, though I had one very kind of bad experience with Harry. When you're in the, I think the first year or two I was in the Legislative Research Commission office during the Clemens administration, Harry Davis had been a lobbyist for the distillers and brewers in the state. Mm-hmm. And when we started out having a pre-session conference of the legislatures, which I thought was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
Kentucky Dam, right?
Yeah, we had one down in Kentucky Dam during the first one there. And Clemens thought it was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
We all did. It was, he got all these legislators together, and both Republicans and Democrats, and they got to know each other, and sides didn't have horns and so on. And they came back, and it increased the time necessary, reduced the time, I should say, of organization, getting the committees and everything organized, leaders. So on,
which is
by about 10 days.
Yeah, which is very important when they meet for 60 days every 2 years.
So, the second one of those we had, nobody knew much about the first one because the first one wasn't, didn't have them all together. We had the House members in one place and the Senators down at Cumberland Falls. But then next time we decided to bring them all together. We decided to organized enough that you could do that. So, to my surprise, we made reservations at the park, Kentucky Dam, for all the legislators who wanted to come. Most of them did. And Harry Davis had set up a whole big nice cabin down there where he was dispersing free booze and all the stillers. Plenty of it. And my commission was very upset about that. And they asked me about it. I said, I didn't know he was going to be there. I made no reservation for him. He made the reservation himself. Well, they said, you have to tell him that that can't be done anymore. We're not going to have it. The next time you see to it that when you go to a state park, the Parks Department is notified that there'll be no other reservations in there, except those that come from the Legislative Research Commission. He even have to have a bunch of vacancies. That's the only way it's going to be. So I had to tell Harry that next time he wasn't going to be able to go. I didn't do it until after the next one came pretty close along. Parks knew about it, and he couldn't get a reservation. Of course, he was down there, but he stayed there. He did the same thing over at motels, someplace not far away. But anyway, he wasn't there at the park. So Harry came to see me after the Chandler's election. And I said, well, Harry, I'm glad to see you. How's everything going and so on? He said, well, I've talked to the governor. And he asked me to come see you. I said, well, how's he doing? I'll be happy he's gotten elected and everything. Said, well, said, he would like for you to resign as soon as possible. He's going to ask for a good resignation, a good many department heads. And particularly wants you to resign. He doesn't want to have to fire you, but he doesn't want any trouble, but he's just resign. Well, I said, now, Harry, I know the governor better than that. That wasn't what he said. I just want you to tell me what he said. He never put it in that term at all about, I don't want me to resign or anything, I don't want to fire a man all that business. And he said, well, if he wants that way, he said he wanted you out of the capsule. And he didn't want to be in the same building with you, and you had to go before he inaugurated. Well, I said, you can go back and tell him that he can't fire me. Only the Legislative Research Commission can fire me. Mm-hmm. And I said, they have offered me a 4-year contract. And they're pretty good lawyers on there. And they said they could draw up a contract that would stick. And I could draw my pay, whether the governor wanted me over here or not. 4 years. Well, Mayor said, well, he wants you out, no doubt about that. I said, well, you tell him I'm sorry that he feels that way about it. But I want you to tell him, you told me what he said, I want you to tell him what I said. You tell him that if he doesn't want to serve in the same building as me, you tell him I'm going to be up here on this fourth floor. Well, maybe the third floor. I think I got some offices now on the fourth floor. I said, Harry, you telling us I'm up here on the legislative floor, the governor's floor, and executive office on the second floor. And if he doesn't want to serve in the same building as me, and I'm going to be here, I can't be fired by even the commission until the legislature convenes in that January. Now, I said, I'm not unaware of the power of governor to, we have an ex officio commission. I'm not unaware of the power of the governor to aid in selecting the speaker or majority floor leaders or minority floor leaders. That he couldn't get a commission named after the session starts that would fire me. So I've been offered a contract, which I think would stick. But they might try to fire me, but I wouldn't be here. They could get me out of the building. Mm-hmm. I might still be drawing my salary. So if he doesn't want that to happen, I'm going to be here. They can't fire me until after they start and change the commission. I said, I'm going to be here. And he'll just have to start his governor's office and business over in the mansion, because I'm not going to be over there either. Harry said, well, he's not going to like that. And I said, I know he's not going to like it. But that's what's going to be. So I shouldn't have done that, I guess, but he shouldn't have done what he told me. As it turned out, what I did, I didn't want to. It would have been stupid of me to be a director of the Legislative Research Commission. It's hard enough. A director of any department is hard enough when you have the full cooperation of the governor. It'd be an untenable position. You couldn't get anything done if you need the governor's mm-hmm. consent on or permission mm-hmm. to be in that kind of situation. And I wasn't about to take the contract, and I told them the reason why, and they agreed me that I had merit in my feelings. I did go to Harry Lee Waterfield, who was coming in as lieutenant governor, and I'd always been friendly with mm-hmm. fairly friendly with Harry Lee, except when he ran against Clements. And I said, Harry Lee, as lieutenant governor, you undoubtedly will be the chairman of the Legislative Research Commission in the first session to meet. And I want to tell you that we have a fine staff here. I don't think I can work with Chandler because he doesn't want to work with me. And I'm going to resign, but I'm going to resign only if you assure me that you will endeavor to keep our professional personnel. I said, you can change some clerks or change some secretaries or something. So those are things they can do, but we have one of the best groups of people I've been told that by the Council of State Governments in Washington, we have the best of any state in the country. Among professionally qualified people, my commission told me to hire anybody we needed without regard to politics or whether it be from Kentucky. And I have some here that can get better jobs in other states right now. But I want you to try to keep them because you need them. And he promised me he would. So I said, okay. The inauguration, you get my resignation. As not to the governor, but my resignation to you as the new chairman of the commission. And I did. You know, that when I came back over to Frankfort 4 years later, everybody, every professional person except two were gone. Mm. Well, as a matter of fact, everyone except one was gone. One of them got back in, who had been fired, but and later became director of it, but Jim Fleming. But the only one left professionally was our librarian. And you might wonder why she stayed. I'll tell you, she was a niece of Ace Dawson, who's the biggest road contractor in the state. And always sported that.
Fascinating. Well, can I ask you whether you put the onus for these removals more on Harry Lee Waterfield or on the governor?
Well, the governor suggested, I'm sure. Waterfield didn't have the nerve to stand up against him. Holmes offered that job to me again when he came in to go the next time. Mm-hmm. He said, there won't be any other application. He said, you'll have it by unanimous support for the old commission. But I said, Bert, I don't want it. He said, why not? You liked it. I said, I liked it better than any job I ever had in it.
Is that true?
Well, I enjoyed it. It was something that I was interested in. I wanted to see it done. And I just was interested in doing it. But I wouldn't want to ever let my staff. Sure, I could. Bear in mind, this is the sessions got to start within 6 weeks after Combs talked to me. You see.
Sure.
Because he was, right after the election, he got a hold of me, wanted me to come back to the job. I was in Washington. And I'd have been in a terrible position because there were people who didn't have the qualifications of the people who had been fired. And they all got good jobs. They didn't stay in Kentucky, but they got good jobs. One of them got the summer kind of job in Ohio. Another went out to Hawaii, one in California. They got good jobs. But I would have gone in there with the legislature with studies I'd had nothing to do with and hadn't been prepared by my people and so on and tried to get a legislative program helpful. Well, the legislator said, hell, what's happened to Lloyd? He just lost his cookies or something.
Yeah, I see your point.
If I could have gone in 6 months, even 6 months, preferably a year, as a session, I could have done something. But anyway, I never felt quite the same about Harry Lee since. But I don't blame him. He didn't quite have the guts to stand up against the governor who had him.
So, interesting point. The hostilities between the two factions greatly increased during the Weatherby administration. And you were a Weatherby man during this period.
Well, I was on a different team.
What What do you attribute to this, you know, just enormous increase in hostilities between the two factions in the Democratic Party during that period? I mean, there has always been, you know, the factionalism, you know, in the modern Kentucky Democratic Party. There was a lot back there during the time of Chandler's first administration and just prior to it. But by most accounts, the hostilities heated up and the bitterness became much greater in the mid-50s during Chandler's second administration. A lot of people, including myself, you know, have been fascinated by that occurrence. Not to say that we like hostility, but trying to explain it. You know, why did it get out of hand? And I once asked Harry Lee Waterfield. I said the name calling that went on, and the wild charges that went on. I said, as Lieutenant Governor, you know, what did you think of that? And he turned the question back to me and he said, well, I, as Lieutenant Governor, never did say those things. The governor said a lot of those things. But he said, if you'll check the newspaper accounts, you'll see that I did not make those wild accusations. And he said that he also caught some grief because he would not get into it in as rough a way as the governor was involved at that point. And as we both know, that the hostilities continued afterwards. I understand even in the 1970s, there was still great hostility between Weatherby and Chandler. Well, between the people who followed, you know, who were associated with both. You know, what happened? What happened during that period?
Well, I can't say for sure. I think it's purely the question of the temperament and the people involved. Chandler is the type of person that you can be for 10 elections as long as you do just exactly what he wants you to do. You cross him one time and he'll never forgive you. Now, Clemens was not that way. Now, Clemens was tough.
Mm-hmm. But he could be volatile. I mean, I think we've both experienced Clemens's temper.
But one of the best examples I know, Henry Ward was opposed to him when he ran for governor. And yet, because of Henry's ability, mm-hmm. Clemens didn't hold it against him. Mm-hmm. He gave him one of the top
jobs
in the
administration.
Because he did it well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was just as loyal to Clemens during mm-hmm. his administration as he had been to
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
But Chapman was not that way. I think in our discussion on...
If I could interject one second, would this again go back to your point about Dan Talbert, whereby you said Talbert, or you hinted that Talbert kind of kept Chandler in mind on legislative matters in particular, but perhaps the absence of a Talbert in the 1950s on political issues as well let the factionalism get out of hand?
There was no one that Happy believed in or listened to during the second administration like he did Dan Talbert's first
mm-hmm.
administration. I think no doubt in my mind about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, didn't I, in a discussion something about one of the tapes somewhere, about the time when I was asking General in the National Guard Convention in San Francisco, I ran and Happy, you remember, they talk about that. And Happy was so glad to see me. And I thought he was trying to make up. And took him out to a ball game, got him in the press box, had him on TV and everything like that because a husband or a cousin of mine had the public relations business for the teams out there. And then he comes back a week or two later and for sales, and when he sees me coming down the street, when he's talking to some of his henchman there, he turns around so he won't have to speak to me because he didn't want them to know he wasn't mad at me anymore. That was rather typical, that.
Mm-hmm. What about Weatherby? You know, in hindsight, looking back, do you think Weatherby in any particular way exacerbated the tensions? I mean, was there, I mean, how much of the blame would you put on Weatherby in this? And why is it that even, you know, by the time of the 1970s, it would appear to many of us that the tensions between Weatherby and Chandler remained, whereas the tensions between, say, Clements and Chandler had largely lessened, been ameliorated. Is that not true?
Well, I can't answer that, except that Weatherby would hold a grudge, and so would Happy. And Clements had the diplomat's touch almost the time that he could keep his henchmen and people from fighting all that, and kind of smooth the way along in a very diplomatic manner. Just different from two men.
But he apparently never did fully smooth Weatherby over in that regard.
Well, no, but there was no need for him to. I don't think Clements would just go out of the way just because he wanted Chandler and Weatherby to be friends to work on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just found it an interesting point because, you know, Weatherby's public image is one, or was one, of a rather mild-mannered person, a rather affable, easygoing person, and quite different in some regards, I think, to Clements, who, you know, many people who were both for and against Clements, you know, would recognize as a man who could be very, very tough. And who could be volatile in a minute, and yet who could get over that volatility and startle people, both getting into it and getting over it, and how he got over it. I mean, in many ways, I think Clemens' personality would keep people aren't prepared for that kind of personality.
Well, I would agree with that. But Clements had a great deal more experience and that type of thing. You look back at his career, and I felt like he was probably the best man trained to be governor of Kentucky by experience that we ever had. Because he started in from the ground up to the national capital, and he knew it all.
I suppose we should backtrack a little bit here again and talk about the LRC. As I understand, and as I recall from when we talked a few years ago, the Legislative Council by 1946 had become pretty much a defunct organization.
Yeah.
It had been a weak organization previously.
Well,
It basically
we start with, because instead of being a legislative council, it was the governor's dominated council. Because the way the original bill was written during Happy's first administration, you had 5 members of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
5 members of the Senate would be appointed by the lieutenant governor, who was chairman of the Senate, and 5 members of the House who'd be appointed by the Speaker of the House, and then 5 department heads appointed by the governor. So you know, out of 15 people, 5 of them appointed by the governor. And the governor could control at least 2 or 3 of the others appointed by the Speaker of the Vice, by the Lieutenant Governor. And it was the governor's council, it wasn't the legislative council. That's why I wanted to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, who wrote that original bill? And was that done inadvertently? Or
no, I don't think it was. It was written by a good firm. One of the things that China did in his first administration, he got the Griffin Hagen and Associates from Chicago to come down and make a study of state government. And of course, the first legislative council was started in Kansas in 1932, if I remember correctly.
I think
that's correct. And this Griffin Hagen report was made in 1936. And they drafted, not physically drafted the bill, but they came up with the recommendations for all the reorganization of part of the Reorganization Act of 1936. Mm-hmm. So they were the ones who brought it that way. Well, that's the way China wanted it.
So you think the original bill was largely set up to give the governor
power, because
control over it?
Yeah, entirely.
But did not the legislature balk at all over this thing called the Legislative Council, which would be basically a tool of the governor? There was no real discussion of that issue?
You hear some talk about it, but the catch in the thing was that it couldn't operate. They did not have a staff enough of people, not politically minded people, but pure researchers and factual people who come up and say, here are the facts on the thing. If you want to, we didn't make recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
When my people did, we gave them the facts on each side and what would happen if this or that came along, or what you did this way and so on. If anything I impressed on anybody, we had a little slogan that appeared on every publication we had. Give the legislature the facts, let them make the opinions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Whereas the earlier council was largely composed of
the only way they get anything was asking these five department heads to give them information.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave them what the governors wanted.
Mm-hmm. That must have made Governor Willis, who succeeded King Johnson in the early 40s there, mighty mad when he inherited that animal.
Well, he inherited not only that, but he inherited the majority of Democrats in both houses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is my implication. As I recall, by 46, they basically pulled the funding out from the old legislative council.
Yeah. Well, we had, that's why we called it, we didn't even call it a council. It was a council, similar to what I helped draft the bills on it, and Clements wanted me to go, that's when I was Commissioner Welfare for the session. And he wanted me to go up to Chicago to the Council of State Governments and find out where some of the best states were, where they had the best working operations, and pattern a bill after that.
Mm-hmm.
And they suggested I go to Illinois, Kansas, and Missouri, who were comparable states to Kentucky in many respects, agriculturally and economically, not industrially, but pretty much so. And in each place, I went to the head of the council, and I said, told him what I was doing, and I said, I want to go over your law, and you tell me what you like about it, what you don't like about it, and what you do if you did it over again. And from that, we drafted the bill.
So you did this pretty much on your own?
Well, I paid my own expenses. I wasn't. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, this was not you did not have a large group with you doing this. You did
Oh,
this
no, no, I did it myself.
Yeah. Basically on your own.
Yeah. John Manning was some help to me,
because
he knew one or two of these people, got in touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I Did I ever tell you about my experience from the first month of council?
I don't believe so.
Well, I went up to the council, and not being on a state expense account, I played my own way, but I wanted to go up there anyway. I had a bull I'd send up to the National Livestock Exposition. And while I was there, I called out the council and told them that, and I'd been at the first meeting of the council way back there when they reorganized from the American Legislators Association into Council of State Governments, which was back in 1934. Well, I knew who to call, and I called out there, and I said, I want to talk to whatever staff member you have that knows the most about legislative councils. And they said, that's our Mr. Wilsey, Herb Wilsey. I said, well, make me an appointment with him. They said, well, he's not in town today. He'll be back tomorrow. Well, I said, ask him if he won't meet me for lunch. I want to talk to him about legislative councils. Well, Herb can tell you this better than I can, but he was flabbergasted because I couldn't tell him exactly. I told him, and he'd never met me before. I hadn't met him before. And he said, well, what is your position? He said, okay. I said, I'm a farmer. Well, what brings you to Chicago? I said, I'm out here showing a bull in the livestock exposition. And he said, well, why are you in this? And I said, well, we're going to have a new governor coming in here in another month. And he's been in the state senate down there, and kind of unhappy with some things. And he's been up in Washington, and he says he's seen that the legislators up there have more staff people and get more facts about things. And we want a fact-finding agency to be impartial and so on. He said, well, what are you going to have to do with it? I said, are you going to run for Senate or something? House? No, I said, no, I don't have anything to do at all. I'm just trying to get some facts together and help draft a bill so it can be passed. He said, well, he still asks about it every time. See, he asked me, he said, well, how can you get it passed? And I said, if I can get one good bill, I can get it passed. And he said, what assurance you have? And I said, you just have to believe it. So he believed me well enough. He wasted a lot of time.
This guy with this bull.
he wasted a lot of time.
Got to run the legislature.
he wasted a lot of time. Letting me, he had enough comments on me. At least he wasted a lot of time to tell me things.
That's a good story.
I've had a lot of people. He's told that to a lot of people up there in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I laughed about it.
So was the Kentucky law basically, let me rephrase that, was the Kentucky law based more on the Illinois statute than on Missouri and the other?
I don't think so, necessarily. That might be. Of course, there are some essentials, and the guy will have to start the first in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked up some things, ideas from all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I got more help back out of Kansas because Guile had been ahead of it longer than the two people in other places, and had. Just had more experience on it.
Mm-hmm.
I really got more help out of the Council of State Governments,
mm-hmm.
and Wilson, the people up there. So they knew all, just 48 of them.
So how many states at this point had a legislative research commission type set up?
Oh, I think about maybe 30, 31, something like that. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of different combinations over the country. Mm-hmm. I wanted to try to remove it as far as I could from the internal politics of the state capital. Mm-hmm. In fact, I wanted to put it over to the University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Not as part of the university, but on the campus.
Mm-hmm. I remember several years ago you mentioned it.
Where we'd have the facilities, the library, and consultants, and that sort of thing. But
yeah, the research tools there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
which you don't have in Franklin.
Of all the people who should have been for it, Dr. Vandenbosch, the head of the political science department, he advised President Donovan not to do it because you have, as he quote, you have politicians running in and out of campus all the time, end quote.
As if that's never happened since. That's cute. Good comment.
Well, can you tell us some more about the functioning of the LRC as it developed
changed so tremendously you wouldn't even know it for the time.
Well, under the original bill, also wasn't the governor, if I recollect correctly, the ex officio chairman?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why. I had two real good constitutional lawyers on my commission, Lewis Cox and Dick Maloney. Mm-hmm. They both agreed when we were working on the bill that the only way that you could make it legal to pay a per diem to the members of the commission when the legislature was out of the session and during the period of adjournment was to have it tied in with the executive branch. Mm. And I still think that's true, though they changed it later.
I was about to ask you that.
If anybody shot in the court, I'd be willing to bet to be knocked down now. Mm. But we had to have some means by which you could pay. Well, we didn't pay the same for them. In those days, it didn't cost anything much because it was only $15 a day to the legislators when they attended one of these official meetings, as they would when they're in session. And we had to tie it in the executive branch. So therefore, we made the governor as the ex officio chairman, or he could appoint the lieutenant governor. And Clemens did it the first day he was chairman.
I recall.
But I think I'd still hold up a good court. Because when the legislature General Assembly adjourned, it's adjourned, sign and die. Mm-hmm. No way you could do any function then.